Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Since 2015, Ari Shapiro has guided us through All Things Considered, but well before becoming a host of NPR's Pioneer News Magazine show, he provided listeners a front row seat to some of the most pressing and interesting stories all around the world. As a London-based international correspondent to covering the White House, the Justice Department, Ari has joined us from the Arctic Circle and Air Force One. So for a different experience of Ari's talents, you might have caught him singing with the music group The Pink Martini or even performing cabaret with actor Alan Cummings. At 44 years old, Ari has a wealth of experiences to share. So he is. I spoke with Ari Shapiro about his new book, The Best Strangers in the World, Stories from a Life Spent Listening. Ari, you know, you spent some two decades with NPR. When did you begin thinking about sharing your work as a journalist in a more personal way, culminating in this book?
I never intended to write a book until I realized that I had started writing one. I was in the middle of the pandemic in a cabin in the Redwood Forests of Northern California in Mendocino County, and started writing what I actually thought was going to be a solo cabaret show, because I've done those before and thought I will do one again. And as I was writing, I realized that it felt less like something one would deliver from the stage and more like something that would go in a book. And I was curious where it would lead. So I took another step and another step and another step. And by the time I left this place in Northern California called Salmon Creek Farm, I had about three chapters written. And I thought, I wonder whether this could ever actually be a whole book. And some 2 years later, it turns out it is.
Yeah, you're talking about a creative process surrounded by one of the most beautiful places, definitely in California and arguably in the country, along the Lost Coast or the North Coast in Mendocino. Given that you've worn so many journalistic hats in your time with NPR, from an international correspondent, White House correspondent, justice correspondent, just to name a few, how did this range really shape the way that you approach your work day in and day out?
Well, for me, the appeal of storytelling has never been about the specific subject of the story. I've never been a person who has FOMO about covering the State of the Union address, or I have to fly to the scene of a natural disaster because it's the biggest story of the day. But I've always just been curious about the world around me, and I've wanted to meet people and understand who they are and how they live. And so even though I have had experience drilling down into one specific beat, like the Justice Department or the White House, what I love about journalism and what I love about my job hosting All Things Considered is the variety of things that it allows me to access. And so the way I describe it in the book is that it feels like my headset and microphone are like a snorkel and mask that allow me to view hidden worlds that I would otherwise never have access to. And then comes the important part, which is that I get to share those worlds with you.
Yeah. And you also had quite the entry point into NPR. You interned under Nina Totenberg, NPR's longtime legal affairs correspondent. We just had Nina on the show. I know, clearly, of a founding mother of NPR, which I know. Yeah. I asked her about that when she was on her show recently about her book, Dinners with Ruth. How formative was that experience?
Incredibly formative, partly because when I started my internship with her, I had never written an article for the school paper. I had never taken a journalism course. And so I really learned from Nina and from the other NPR journalists who I was helping. You know, when I was her intern, I used to transcribe the interviews that she would do so that she could then use them to find quotes, use my transcripts to find quotes. And in transcribing the conversations she had, I paid close attention to when she asked a follow-up question, how long she would let a person talk before she jumped in, when she would encourage a person to keep going. And those are skills that I still use to this day.
Yeah. And now it's culminating in a book, which really allows you to pause and reflect in a way that, as journalists, can often get away from us, given the constant nature of our work. Mm-hmm. Did you leave with a deeper or a different understanding of the meaning behind the reporting that you've done?
Yeah, what I realized is that, as you say, covering the news every day can be like watching a swollen river go by, where there's branches and debris and leaves, and it's all going so fast that it's hard to cling to any one thing. But as I was writing this book, what I realized is that certain stories I've told, certain people I've met, have kind of snagged on me as they go by and stuck around. And those people, those stories, have shaped the person I am. And the flip side of that is that the person I am has also shaped the stories that I've told. And so as journalists, of course, we want to be a surrogate for the listener. We want to approach stories with objectivity, but we also bring our full selves to the act of storytelling. And part of what I wanted to explore in this book is the boundaries where those two ideas meet, the wanting to sort of put yourself in a box because the story's not about you, and also wanting to bring your life experience and history and identity to the stories that you tell. And that's a difficult push-pull. There's a real tension there.
Was it an enjoyable process?
It was enjoyable in the way that a challenge and learning a new skill is enjoyable. You know, there are things that I enjoy because I know I'm good at them. Cooking is a familiar activity because I do it every single day. This was a very unfamiliar activity. And for that reason, it was difficult. And because of the difficulty, it was enjoyable. There's something satisfying about trying a new skill and not knowing whether you're going to be any good at it or not. There's something nice about continuing to learn all throughout your life. And this was a real learning process for me.
Yeah. And the title is The Best Strangers in the World, Stories from a Life Spent Listening. Was landing on a title an easy lift? What went into deciding on a title?
Well, the truth is, I had a working title that, for various reasons that we don't need to get into, I was not able to use. And so when I was almost done writing the manuscript, I needed to find a new title. And all of the title ideas I had either centered me or you, the reader slash listener, or the people whose stories I'm telling in the book. And one reason that I love the title, The Best Strangers in the World, even more than the working title that I had before, is that it centers the people whose stories make up the body of this book. I mean, in a way, this is almost a memoir told through the stories of others. And so I love that it puts them first.
Yeah. And by listening, you know, when reading the bio for the book or the description for the book, I mean, what is so important, the better that we understand each other, the better we all are off, right? As a society, to find connection and commonality with those who may seem different and to remind us that we're all human. And we can't really think about that without taking in the past 3 years during a pandemic and the unrest within our country, around the world. Did that reinforce this belief for you and perhaps light a fire to write this book in Mendocino?
Totally. I think listening is a superpower that we all have if we choose to access it. And I don't think it's a coincidence that I wrote this book in September of 2020. I started writing this book in September of 2020 when we were all feeling so isolated from each other. And the thread that runs through the book is the experiences we share and the commonalities we have and the act of empathy and seeing the world through the eyes of somebody else. And so now that the book is done and I look at it as a whole, I realize that in telling these stories about connection, I was in some way responding to the isolation that we were all feeling in the depths of the pandemic.
Once readers get to take it in, what do you hope they take away?
You know, there are these wealthy, powerful forces that are invested in telling us why we're different from everybody, that our social media feeds reinforce our pre-existing ideas about the world. Brands tell us that we're a Coke drinker versus a Pepsi drinker, and that makes us somehow better or worse. Politicians, of course, want us to identify with their party, with their followers, and vilify everybody else. And those forces are powerful, but fundamentally, we all share so much more than we might realize on a daily basis. And I hope that this book underscores that for people.
Last question. Is there going to be a cabaret counterpart to this book sometime in the future? Since it kind of began, is that?
Yeah, I would not rule it out. I certainly think it's possible, but if it exists in the future, it's something I have not started writing in the present. So we'll see. I'll be as surprised as you are.
Thank you so much, Ari.
It's been great talking with you. Thank you for your interest.
And that is NPR All Things Considered host Ari Shapiro talking with us about his new book, The Best Strangers in the World, Stories from a Life Spent Listening. The book was just released yesterday. Up next, we're going to head to the Silver State. Parts of Nevada are expected to see some of the best wildflower blooms Nevada has seen in years. We're going to have plant scientists that will join us and tell us where the best spots might be and how to take in this rare sight responsibly. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This week is technically the first week of spring, even though it might not feel like it yet. Many of us might be eager, ready to say goodbye to the seemingly endless winter weather. But in addition to easing drought conditions, there's also some buzz in the air that this year's wildflower season could be epic. In past years, with torrential rains, stunning super blooms have attracted huge crowds in California. But our neighbor to the east could also see one of its best wildflower seasons in years. So joining us to tell us more about the super bloom forecast in Nevada, where some of the best spots might be, and how you can view these responsibly is Jerry Thieme, curator at University of Nevada, Reno, and Tiffany Pariah, an ecologist with the Desert Research Institute. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Tiffany, I want to start with you because, as we mentioned, you're an ecologist with the Desert Research Institute, which has centers in Reno and Las Vegas. Tell us more about the institute and the work that you do there.
Yeah, so we work all around the world, all seven continents. So the desert part of that is a little bit of a misnomer, but I focus my work down here in the Mojave Desert. We have scientists that in three divisions, the division of hydrology, atmospheric sciences, and earth and ecosystem sciences. So we work with agencies, with state governments for restoration and basic research.
You're also a scientific illustrator. How do you integrate art into your scientific research?
I believe art is one of the best ways to proliferate scientific fact to folks. We tend to have a lot of jargon and when we speak, and what better way to disseminate that research than through means that more people can access.
What are some of your favorite art pieces that you've done?
So I do a lot of botanical illustration. So tying back to the wildflowers, botanical illustration has a long storied history. Botanists still use those drawings today to identify plants when we put them through keys. And I continue that long history, the work that I do.
Wonderful. Well, Jerry, you are at the herbarium at UNR. You and your team, what kind of work do you do at the university?
Well, we are putting together an annotated checklist for the flora of Nevada. There's about 3,600 different species of plants that occur here. And we go out and do field work during the summers and when things are in flower. And I dig up and press plants and make scientific specimens out of them so we have a permanent record of what is out there.
How diverse is plant life in Nevada and the Great Basin?
It's quite diverse. I think Nevada's it's in the top 10 of states as far as number of species goes, because it's nothing like California. I mean, California is sort of a subcontinent unto itself as far as flowers go. But anyway, it's quite diverse out here.
Given that you began working on plants in the 1970s and 80s, what sparked your interest, planted that seed, you know, to pursue a career in studying them?
Well, I've always been out of doors, and I was have a college degree in wildlife management. And when you study wildlife, you also have to study plants because, of course, you know, wildlife eats plants. And I was just kind of fascinated by the fact that people could name plants. And then I just took an elective in botany when my senior year in college, and everything just clicked. That's all I can say.
So, Tiffany, you told the Reno Gazette Journal that you anticipate it's going to be a great wildflower season. What are the ingredients to a great wildflower season?
So part of what I research is seed ecology. So plants produce, flowering plants produce seeds. You can get into the weeds there, if you will. But the plants that produce seeds, those seeds require certain cues, if you will, to germinate or grow, sprout. And all species have a different set of cues and a different timing for those cues to occur. So you might have species that need a hot monsoon rain, several hot monsoon rains. You might get species that require a cold rain and then multiple cold rains followed by a warming that increases gradually. And so when all those things click, all those things happen in the right order and the right timing, you get wildflower blooms.
You're talking about a lot of circumstances that need to go right in order to have a super bloom. And I would imagine it's going to be different in different parts of the state of Nevada.
Exactly.
Jerry, for listeners up in the Tahoe-Reno area, how is wildflower season shaping up? What kind of forecast do you have?
Well, you got to keep in mind, we're 400 miles north of Las Vegas and at least 2,000 feet higher here in Reno. I mean, it spit snow here about an hour ago. So we're a long ways off from talking, you know, from things actually being in flower. But things have really shaped up. We've had plenty of moisture, and we also had fall moisture. And it's nice when you get a good douse of rain in October and November, because a lot of plants will germinate then, and then they'll just sit as a rosette through the winter and absorb moisture, and then they take off in the spring. So I think we're going to be in really good shape, but it's going to be early May before things really start popping around here.
I was really surprised when you noted the last good wildflower seasons for the area that we're talking about was 2017, but before that was 2005. So we're talking more than a decade in distance. What were the weather ingredients that made those years and potentially, hopefully this year, remarkable for these blooms?
Well, in 2005, we had a fall rain, and then on New Year's Eve, for the next 24 hours, we got 3 feet of snow in Reno. And basically 2 to 3 feet all the way out across the state. And in the next week, we got another foot of snow. So we had all that great moisture, and, you know, it slowly melted and sunk in. And then after that, every month or so, we got another douse of moisture, and it didn't get real hot. It didn't just all of a sudden, you know, go to 90 or 100. So the plants developed, and every time it rained, they kept growing. And it was just a fantastic year. No matter where you went, you were knee-deep in wildflowers out here.
Yeah. Tiffany, as you said, it's going to look different in different parts of the state at different times. Mm-hmm. Do you have kind of a regional timeline for this potentially great wildflower season?
Yeah, and what's exactly what Jerry was talking about, it can even be different around the Las Vegas Valley. So, for example, parts of Lake Mead, so Willow Beach, down south near Laughlin, those areas are already starting to go off. In California, Anza Borrego started going off in the winter, and it is still going because they keep getting rain. Whereas one of my study sites, Tule Springs Fossil Beds National Monument, the plants are just starting to come up there. We have a few wildflowers peeking out, but it's just hopefully going to keep getting better and better as we move along, as long as it doesn't get too hot too quickly.
Yeah. And given that in the last recent years, California, Nevada, and more broadly, the Southwest has endured years of severe drought, has that had any impact on wildflowers and the rest of plant life throughout Nevada? Tiffany?
Oh, absolutely. There was a year, it was 20, 2021, Nevada, or the Southern Nevada area, had a historic drought, and I referred to it as the zero year. There were areas where no wildflowers came out, absolutely none. It was the first year there was no monsoon detected in the Vegas area on record, and the plants responded, and that has impacts not only just for the plant life going forward, but also animals that rely on those plants as well, like the desert tortoise.
Yeah, I mean, those ripple effects are far and wide. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jerry Thiem and Tiffany Pariah about how this spring could be an incredible wildflower season in Nevada. Okay, so the key word that we're all talking about here is could be. So what ideally needs to happen weather-wise over the next several weeks to make super blooms in parts of Nevada a reality? Jerry?
Well, I think right now we're up here, we're set up real well for it. As long as it doesn't just all of a sudden turn to 90 or 95 degrees, we should be fine. It would be nice, though, if we started getting some warm weather and then maybe in a month or so get in one more rain. I think that's what would really set it off.
What are some of the best areas for people to see?
I would go east of Reno to the lower elevation areas around Fallon and Fernley, what is with the Lahontan Basin, a former Lake Lahontan back in the Pleistocene. The sandy areas. Sandy areas are remarkable in that in dry years, there's just shrubs out there, and you don't think there's any seeds, but then when you get good wet years, the number of plants that come up are just phenomenal. And if you think about the super blooms in Southern California, they're mostly annual plants that produce those shows.
Tiffany, you mentioned Laughlin, Lake Mead. What other areas of the state do you think will have some of the best blooms this spring?
Yeah, so other parts of the Mojave, so the eastern Mojave, western Mojave, out towards even Death Valley's in California. But if you're going toward that side of the state here in Nevada, you'll start to see things coming up, and then the higher elevations will start to go off. Right now, Lake Mead, Valley of Fire are all starting to go off. And hopefully, as Jerry said, if we don't get 100 plus degree weather here soon, maybe a couple more spring showers, and we'll keep these going.
Valley of Fire is beautiful. I worked in Vegas for a couple years. And, you know, Death Valley isn't that far of a drive. It's a couple-hour drive. I did it as a day trip on a weekend. What's interesting when you brought up Death Valley was that last month officials, because the area can be known for wildflowers in the spring months, they said that likely they won't see a super bloom this year despite the record rainfall. But you're saying it still can be promising and beautiful to go check it out.
Absolutely. And sometimes folks focus on super blooms, but those happen when, as I said, you get those right cues all happening at the right time. And then certain species are like, yes, we're going off. But in years where that doesn't happen, that doesn't mean other species haven't had their needs met and they're coming up as well. So they're always gems. The desert especially is known for little belly flowers, and it rewards those who take the time to take a closer look.
Yeah. We're having this conversation because wildflower tourism has exploded in popularity, and it can be good on the one hand, but it also can be harmful. I mean, there's just more people who want to experience the blooms in person and, you know, share it on the gram, social media. But it has been a big problem in parts of California in recent years. Last month, even the city of Lake Elsinore in Southern California, they closed a popular trail to all visitors this spring after experiencing, quote, Disneyland-sized crowds in previous super bloom years. Are either of you concerned about the impact that an influx of tourists that are excited and want to take it in, but how they can impact the flowers and the environment? Jerry?
That doesn't seem to be a problem here. We just simply don't have that many people in Nevada, and it's a ways out from Reno to the deserts. Places around Lake Tahoe, though, can get trampled quite bad. I know Tahoe Meadows. But the high mountain stuff this year is going to be way late, and I would imagine there's some plants aren't going to flower. By the time they get out from under the snow, it's going to be too late in the season.
How about you, Tiffany? Is this a concern of yours?
Yeah, a little bit. Just some of the areas that get a bit popular. People think, oh, well, if I just, I'm only one person, I'll go off trail. It's only a couple flowers. But you think of the impact over time, and how these super blooms occur is a result of what's called soil seed banks. So the seeds that these flowers produce in mass, so a single, you know, California gold poppy can produce hundreds of seeds, for example, and those seeds lie waiting in the soil, and they form this seed bank that I study and wait for those right cues. So if you're trampling flowers, and then that one poppy could have produced hundreds of seeds, then you get a bunch of people trampling more flowers. You start exponentially, there's hundreds and thousands of seeds that are no longer going to be produced for our next super bloom to occur. So just thinking about that, staying on the trails, we want people to experience their natural areas and get as much joy that I do out of wildflowers when I see them. But think about the future so we can keep having these conversations.
Well, Tiffany and Jerry, thank you so much for the conversation. Jerry Team is a curator at the University of Nevada, Reno. Tiffany Pariah is with the Desert Research Institute. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Insight's Concert Connect showcases talented musicians to check out locally and live in Sacramento and beyond. And by beyond, we mean a reasonable driving distance away. With the help of CAP Radio's Nick Bruner and Andrew Garcia, they have searched for the cream of the crop concerts that celebrate Sacramento's music scene. You might call Nick and Andrew experienced curators for the arduous task and thorough work that they do to share with us their top concert picks. They do the heavy listening, so you can show up to these concerts with the knowledge of a fan and impress your friends. If it wasn't on the gram, it didn't happen, right? So thanks for joining us, Nick and Andrew.
What a grandiose introduction, Vicky. That makes me feel like my job, maybe a monkey can't do my job.
Yeah. The ego is rising.
Oh, it's huge. I'm not going to be able to get out of the door. Thank you.
Well, Andrew, I'm going to start things off with you because the first artist, I love the name of this band, Unknown Mortal Orchestra, performing Ace of Spades March 27th.
Yes, quite the band name. Who knows what it means? We'll see, but it is quite compelling, yes.
What do you love about them?
Well, they've got a new album out. It's called V, and there's something that I think is quite fun for this particular album and Unknown Mortal Orchestra in general. It's a bit of a, this is a weird metaphor, but the cocktail Dark and Stormy.
Yeah.
Rum,
okay.
Ginger beer, some lime. It's got some sweetness to it. So he's able to create these really lush soundscapes and bring you in with some of the sweetness. But as the name implies, there's a bit of a sort of darker sort of sorrowfulness maybe underneath it all. It's about his family in Hawaii. So it's got that tropical aspect. But there's also sort of his family has mostly left Hawaii. And during this album, his uncle had a terminal illness diagnosis. So it's music that is able to move you and groove you, but also has this really rich sort of nuance to it. So a dark and stormy.
I think that's a fair comparison, given that the roots are in Hawaii and also New Zealand as well. Mm-hmm. It is kind of a tiki drink. I have had one or two of those in a tiki bar. So we're going to listen to a song called Layla, and that is credited as a tribute to his mother. So we're going to take a listen from the new album, V. Mm-hmm. Andrew, the dark and stormy is sinking in. I totally understand.
Right, yeah, a bit of a weird metaphor, but I think it fits quite nicely.
When did you discover them?
I've been listening for a while now. This is their fifth album, of course. V, I think somewhere around the third album is when I got hip. And that one's a bit more about modern life and the trappings and, you know, texting on the phone and stuff. Also really groovy, really great, but also has something to say, which I like.
And they'll be at Ace of Spades on Monday, March 27th. Mm-hmm. So we're going from a more tropical feel from Hawaii and New Zealand and heading to Idaho. Right? You're the next band that you want to profile. You know, Idaho, we might think of potatoes, but there's also Built to Spill, which is an indie rock institution since the 90s. What do you love about them?
Yes, I couldn't quite come up with a cocktail that was really about Built to Spill, potatoes, vodka, I guess.
Just a gimlet.
Just a straight chaser vodka. What I really like, and I think contributes to like why they've been around for so long, is it's Doug March's, the lead singer's, sort of ethereal, tenory vocals that go on. There's some sort of otherworldly quality, and I think it lends itself to a lot of their introspective sort of dream rock kind of tracks, but it also lends itself to the sort of punkier type of stuff that they've got going on too.
And I think they embrace their Boise roots.
Yeah, I think they've embraced that. They've embraced sort of their forerunner as indie rock people, and very prolific as well, keeping it going, which I commend.
And they will be at Harlow's on March 29th. We're going to listen to their song Gonna Lose from their latest album, When the Wind Forgets Your Name. You're singing along, Andrew.
It's so good. It's so great. You could kind of just really sink into those slightly weird but very endearing type of vocals that he's got going on.
All right. We're going to head further east now to outside of Chicago, or Chicago rather. The next musician is Namdi, which formerly known as Namdi Ogbonaya. Nick, mm-hmm. did I say that correctly?
Yes, I believe so.
A rapper and multi-instrumentalist. What do you love about Namdi?
I love so much about what Namdi it brings to each one of his albums. And it's this impossible mixture of punk and rap and R&B and rock and pop and these disparate sort of genres that don't always play nice together.
Who cares about boxes?
Well, precisely. Mm-hmm. And it's great to find an artist like Namdi to be able to, what did I describe him as? A satisfyingly unclassifiable, I think, is how I view his music. It's just, he's got such a great energy and positivity, and he keeps you just bouncing back and forth.
We're going to listen to a song from his latest album, Please Have a Seat. What do you love about the last album?
Well, it sort of goes back to what I was just saying. I feel like all of his records are what they have in common are this artful mixture of different styles and genres, and what's different about each one is how he uses those colors and ingredients to make these records. Like, it's like you'll go from a straight pop track into like a song with that, you know, very little vocals and a lot of different swirling instrumentation. It's just, I don't know. Like I said, it's unclassifiable, satisfyingly. Yeah.
I love that. It's refreshing, you know?
Yep.
You don't always have to follow rules.
It's nice to not have to think about describing his music in a lot of ways and just kind of listen back and just see what he has to say.
Yeah, and feeling it. Mm-hmm. He's going to be performing at the Starlit Room and Harlow's Friday, March 31st. We're going to listen to his song Smart Ass from his most recent album, Please Have a Seat. And Namdi's going to be performing at the Starlit Room at Harlow's Friday, March 31st. How do you think he's going to be as a live performance?
I think he's going to be just as surprising and fun as every other track on his albums are. I think that I haven't seen him perform live yet. So, I mean, you know, it's all sort of a crapshoot and up to the artist and how they're feeling and what they're up to. But I've got a feeling that he's going to provide an electric show. At the showcase. Oh, and something I forgot to mention, Biggie. The whole reason I found about Namdi to begin with was thanks to Elk Grove artist Damien Verrett. He makes music as So Much Light. And Namdi featured on Damien's album for Anti Records a few years back called Oh Yuck. And I was like, oh, who's this guy? And found it and just went down this wonderful rabbit hole. So I never get a chance to actually thank Damien enough for that introduction. So if he's out there, Damien, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
On Insight. Thank you, Damien. Next artist, Freddie Gibbs, and one that our Insight producer, Victor, is very excited to see come to Sacramento.
All right.
Rapper from Gary, Indiana.
Yes. Vicar has very good taste. Tough as leather persona. I really love Freddie Gibbs because I feel like growing up in Gary, Indiana, I don't know if it's by virtue of this, but I feel like he wields the most potent components of West Coast and East Coast rap, making a sound that's uniquely all his own. He's just fantastic. He's an incredible performer to see live and to just watch. He's electric.
Yeah. He's going to be performing at Ace of Spades Sunday, April 2nd. And the song we're going to listen to is Cataracts from the collaborative Bandana album from renowned producer Madlib.
Old school, Chevy thing, Cadillacs, smoking on that good for my cataracts. Up this bad food, fast food, getting fat, nine extended clip attached, swinging it like a battle axe, living like Vita broke, these smokers up and bagging. I'm Tonio Montana drink, mama wasn't having that. Ain't no better, we pass them, we was passing rats. She wet my wood up, dry my off for you, pass it back. Pass it back, pass the codeine got me passing out. Crime mixing with crayon gray, I'm trying to see what that about. Remember we hit that lick and tied up them Crips in that Atlanta house. Had to smoke that came along with us cause he was gonna rat us out. Seemed like my actions was and I can't sympathize. Generation X is generation genocide. Your social stat make you fantasize about a homicide. To me, the God of lies, the black man personified. Participating in
killing my own in search of wealth. So he come knocking at the door of your home. We don't fit there. I knew the Lord was in the room when my daughter took her first breath. Cold turkey on the dope, had to gain the knowledge of self. In my old school, Chevy thing, Cadillac. Good, good, good for my cataracts. Bad food, fast food.
All right, the booth just exploded when that song came on.
He does this impossible dance on almost every track where you hear him almost lose the rhythm of the track, and then he wills it back onto the beat. He's got this confidence that it's like, oh, he almost wills the music to how fast he is rapping.
Yeah.
And that's I think that's expertly the Madlib and Freddie Gibbs are just chocolate and peanut butter.
To us about a Madlib production. What makes it so unique and special?
Well, to me, what I love about his discography is just how vast it is, and frankly, just how it jumps all over the place. It's like he'll go from a sparse jazz beat. He's got like a deep, deep, deep love of jazz, and so that'll go and go and go. But then it'll give way to like a 3-second clip of an old TV commercial or something of the like. And then it goes back to the beat. It'll take a pause just long enough to make you think that it's over before tripping over itself on the way back in. And then, out of nowhere, a giant left turn like a Bollywood beat from 1974 or something like that. What I'm saying is I love how he keeps my brain busy, jumping from reference to reference and never overstaying his welcome. All of his cuts are just like really concise.
You know, Andrew and Nick, thank you so much for joining us other Thursday.
It's the best part of every other week.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much for Insights Concert Connect. And those are Cap Radio hosts Nick Bruner and Andrew Garcia. You can learn more about Cap Radio's Concert Connect on our Instagram account on Cap Radio. And of course, Hey Listen, airing Saturdays from 3 to 5 and 8 to 10 p.m. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast or connect with us and shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.